Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Now we're going on to South Carolina.
On to South Carolina.
We are headed, of course, to South Carolina.
I'm going to be in a red eye to South Carolina. So let's get ready for that.
And we took a red eye to Amelie's in Rock Hill, South Carolina, for this edition of the Local News Roundup. This morning we get to update on all things having to do with Saturday's South Carolina primary. We hear about the latest polls, this week's Charleston debate, get some local perspective on what's at stake for Joe Biden, who received a major, if anticipated, endorsement this week, and see if Bernie or Tim Steyer have weakened the former VP's firewall here. And we'll get updates on other news around the area, including some recent decisions at CMS, Cam Newton's future, and the final CIAA tournament in Charlotte, at least for a while. Because the eyes of the nation are on the Palmetto State, and because we're here today, we're getting a little help from someone who knows the territory. Kaylin Dickerson, or Derrickson, excuse me, Kaylin. Kaylin Derrickson is a reporter for the Rock Hill Herald, making her debut on the Roundup. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Mary C. The applause for you is tepid here. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV. Good morning. And Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum, which I don't think they have in Rock Hill.
We do have a few customers, but just a few.
Do you? Okay. Well, welcome to you.
But they're down here.
So prior to the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire and Nevada primaries, the major media did all sorts of scene-setter stories talking to voters and taking their temperature. And Kaylin, I'm just curious if the same thing has happened here.
We've definitely talked to voters here. What I found is that students are way more aware of the national attention in South Carolina. Your average professional here wasn't so aware. I had a couple people tell me, like, I've been so wrapped up in my business, I haven't had a chance to even look at the candidates, and a lot of people didn't really know that there was a primary coming up. But, you know, your students were very aware. They hadn't decided yet on which candidate, but we're definitely planning to vote on Saturday.
So that neuters my second question to you, which was going to be, has the atmosphere changed at all since the campaigns all shifted their headquarters here and the Charleston debate took place? No real difference.
There hasn't been a huge difference. We've had a few surrogates come. John Kerry came to campaign for Biden. But the only candidate who's really come is Pete Buttigieg, who came last night.
So for our North Carolina listeners, primaries here work differently than they do in North Carolina. So who can vote? Who's voting tomorrow? Who can be in the booth tomorrow?
Well, in South Carolina, they don't register by party. They have open primaries, so Republican can go vote tomorrow in the Democratic primary.
All the Republicans are voting for Bernie, is that right?
We've definitely seen that. I've talked with a few people here who have that thought. No one has confirmed that they're definitely doing it, but they've told me they'll decide on Saturday morning.
What kind of turnout are they expecting, not just in Rock Hill, but throughout South Carolina? Or do you know?
I think they're expecting a pretty good turnout. You know, primary turnout is traditionally low, but I think this is a unique year in that there isn't a Republican primary, so you may see a higher turnout.
And we keep hearing, Steve, that South Carolina is the first primary that is truly representative of the country because of the demographic makeup of South Carolina. First of all, is that true? Does that give this primary more gravitas, or do other things come into play?
So, I mean, I think the electorate, Democratic electorate tomorrow will be 2/3 African-American. And, I think you could make an argument that Nevada was a bit closer to what the United States looks like. This will be, Joe Biden's been saying this all along, that this is his strongest supporters. This is the first opportunity they have to really weigh in on his campaign. And I think, though, what to me is interesting for Vice President Biden is, let's say hypothetically he gets his first place finish, which he's expecting. Mm-hmm. The way the calendar works, you know, boom, then we come right into Super Tuesday. millions of people, maybe not millions, hundreds of thousands of Democrats have already voted. Whatever bounce he gets, like, he's going to get 2 days, right? I mean,
it's going to be quick.
But for people who haven't voted in those, I think it's 14 Super Tuesday states, including North Carolina, if people are on the fence, would the result here influence them?
So we still have 1 day of early voting left up in North Carolina. And I've talked to a number of people who are waiting, who have said they are waiting to early vote on who the Democrat would be to see who wins in South Carolina tomorrow.
Also, the name of this game is money, and I've heard that Vice President Biden hasn't been able to have as many ads up in these Super Tuesday states, and Michael Bloomberg has been blanketing these states, and he won't be on the South Carolina ballot, and he will be for the first time on Super Tuesday, so that also figures into it. If he gets this bounce, will he be able to follow up with putting his presence in these states, and how much will that count?
And let's just say hypothetically that Super Tuesday was 1 week later, right? You win South Carolina, you get a whole week of free media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be the story every night on cable news. Biden's back. Can he, and he's just, there's just not that much time. You're going to get two nights of that coverage, and everyone votes. And then, if we look up at Charlotte, Biden, there just hasn't been much of a presence.
No.
He just doesn't have the resources to compete.
And you see, he's already lowering expectations because he really needs to not only win, but win by a lot.
Yep.
And he has said, well, if I win by 1 point, it's a win. Well, that's true, but.
Well, this is I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Steve brings up an awesome point that, we haven't seen the presence from former Vice President Joe Biden that we've seen from Tom Steyer. And we've seen and heard about Tom Steyer since last summer. Bloomberg has a presence in Charlotte that we haven't seen from Biden, but there is still a large contingent of people that you talk to at the polls that, if they're of a certain age range and African-American, then they're loyal to Joe Biden.
Yeah. This state is supposed to be Joe Biden's so-called firewall, and Face the Nation anchor Margaret Brennan on CBS last Sunday asked Joe Biden if the results of the previous contests in Nevada and Iowa and New Hampshire had lowered expectations about South Carolina.
South Carolina, though, was your firewall.
You said it, my firewall. I've never
said it. The campaign has said it's your firewall.
No, it's not firewall. I said I'm going to do well there.
Okay, so it isn't just Donald Trump who denies things that we have tape on. And we do have tape on this. Here's what Biden said with NBC just before the Iowa caucuses.
I think I have a real firewall in South Carolina.
There you go. Kaylin, does he?
Well, I think we're seeing that it's being questioned. I've talked with some Biden supporters who are questioning if the firewall comment is true, and I think some voters take offense to it with him not really being here in the state. Like you said earlier, Tom Steyer has been able to be here. He has the largest staff. His wife moved to Columbia, so he's more accessible to voters. So to kind of call it your firewall but not really be here, I think some voters.
Also, people, I think he realizes that is people might resent that in the last debate where he said, I am here to earn your vote. And you could see, because voters don't like to be thought of as, taken for granted. African-American voters are very diverse. They're not monolithic. They want to hear from all the candidates. I've been struck at how astute the voters are down here. I've talked to a lot of them. And any rally you go to, we were at Pete Buttigieg's, and they, they've been to like six of them. It's like, well, I'm seeing him for the second time. And I saw Kamala when she was still in it. And I'm going to see Biden tomorrow. And they are really studying this up. And many of them are still undecided, too.
Yeah. John, you mentioned that John Kerry was here as a surrogate for Joe Biden. And he said when he was here that this state, South Carolina, will be the Biden's real test of electability against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he say that?
Trump's
not in the contest.
Right.
How will we know that?
Right. Well, Biden has long held this claim that he is the only candidate with the experience to really go head-to-head with Trump. And Kerry came here to kind of defend that. And I think it was questioned with Biden's performance in the early states. So he, wanted to really show voters, you know, he still is that candidate who can do that.
And John Kerry, Steve, also said that polls show Biden leading Trump nationally more than any other candidate in the general election. Is that true?
I mean, it was definitely true, I think, in the fall and at the end of the year. I mean, the polls I've seen most recently actually show Senator Sanders, like, maybe performing head-to-head the best. I mean, Biden's definitely one of the better performers of all the candidates. But it's just but yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that former Vice President Biden overall has done, yeah. I mean, has had a good head-to-head standing against the president. But Senator Sanders is also, the polls show, in a really good position.
Biden has never won a primary all the times he's run for president. So this would be, no, it's true. This would be the first time. But you have to say, you know, the wild card is news. When we have the coronavirus or a foreign policy problem, that's when Biden shines.
Or the stock market dropping.
Yeah, because he can say, this is what I have done, and that experience shows. So you can never discount things that are unexpected.
So this week, because this is the firewall for Joe Biden, Joe Biden has been talking a lot about Barack, not President Obama, mm-hmm. Barack.
My
first name buddy, the former president. Is that working? Will that cause the center to hold among particularly African-American voters?
I think so, because to a certain extent, though, I think that the vice president still has a lot of ground game as far as the former president Barack Obama's love in the African-American community. There's still a lot of affection for him, and I think that, smartly so, Joe Biden is connecting himself to that affection from the African-American community. It could work, but I think people, like you said, and like you said, Mary, are educating themselves, and that's why it's been complicated, I think, for people to make a decision between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, because they're completely different characters, but they have connections with. I saw a poll that, you know, Bernie Sanders has a lot of support from younger millennial types, but older seniors really don't support him, and it's the vice versa for Joe Biden.
I've heard that from older voters in particular. Barack Obama trusted this man. And for them, particularly older voters here in South Carolina who lived through so much racial unrest and even violence, the fact that he would agree to play second fiddle and work for this young black man means a lot to them.
It still does,
and because they remember this in ways maybe younger voters don't. And I hear that all the time. That's why the Jim Clyburn endorsements don't really generally mean that much, but that meant a lot because he's lived through that as well. And when he brought Miss Emily, his late wife, into it,
right.
There's that tradition and legacy. So when you see the polls bumping up now a little bit for Biden, I think those things make a difference.
So when we did this program from Winthrop University a couple weeks ago, Steve, Democratic strategist Antoine Seawright said that he believed this state will pick the eventual nominee. And given the two wild cards in this race, Mike Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, and the fact that Bloomberg isn't even on the ballot here, do you believe that's true? And I have 45 seconds.
Oh, my goodness. that's a tough one. I mean, I think you could definitely say the winner, eventual winner, would be in the top three. I mean, I think it's just one thing that's so weird is the calendar. National Democrats kind of changed the calendar this year to front load it, to help the establishment candidate. And all of a sudden, those rules are helping Bernie Sanders.
So is this primary really about second place if this is Biden's to win?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have to take a break. We're here at Amelie's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. We'll talk about lots of things, but more on the primary in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're at Amelie's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. If you have not been to downtown Rock Hill, South Carolina, this place is hopping. It's happening. Good food, not just here, but around us here in Rock Hill. And I'm surrounded at this table at Amelie's by Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News. Kaylin Derrickson joins us for the first time. She's a reporter for the Rock Hill Herald. Mary C. Curtis, columnist and contributor to Roll Call and WCCB-TV. And Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Billionaire. That wouldn't be me. Tom Steyer has been plowing money into South Carolina. I think he spent $17 million at last report on advertising. Was he targeting Democrats at large, or was he specifically looking to take away Biden Democrats from the African-American community? Because they've seemed to, a lot of those folks have seemed to glom on to him.
Well, I've been talking with them, and he has been down here a lot. Mm-hmm. He's also been doing a lot of mailings, and as I said, people are paying attention. They don't throw them away. They look at them, and he's been talking about issues of racial justice. He's made that a centerpiece. He's talked about reparations. He's the only one that's talked about that, and talked about, when I interviewed him when he was in North Carolina, that he has been in the fight for many years. He and his wife started a community bank and other things. Now, he was dinged on the debate about private prisons investments by Joe Biden, and he said, oh, I took it out of that. But people are really taking him seriously, and I'm not sure what his path is out of South Carolina, but right now he is there. And it is pretty clear to me that a lot of those votes would be going to Joe Biden if they weren't going to Tom Steyer.
So whenever we bring Tom Steyer's name up, we talk about money because he has a lot of it,
oh, yeah.
Spent a lot of it, but you got an exclusive interview with him, Kaylin, and he told you, quote, I don't think it's about money. I've never thought it was about money. I've always thought that the question in this race for everyone is message. And he also told you that voters are smart and that they are listening. If he doesn't win here, does that mean they heard what he had to say and rejected it, or that Biden's support was simply too difficult to overcome?
I think he'll have to make decisions after the South Carolina primary. It is the only state that he's in third place. He's high in the polls, and I think nationally he's not really doing too hot. But it is that accessibility. He's able to see voters and connect with them, and he claims it's not about the money, but he's definitely making a jab at them.
And he's gotten significant support from the longest serving, I think, African-American state representative in South Carolina, Gilda Cobb Hunter. Oh. She's taken a job as his national political director for the Steyer campaign, and she says the shift is coming. She says the black vote will be fragmented. I see a four-way split happening between Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Tom Steyer, and Bernie Sanders. That's in South Carolina. If Biden's firewall does not hold, is that how this race will turn out, do you think? Those four.
I could see that happening.
Okay.
I definitely could see the black vote being fragmented, not just in South Carolina, in North Carolina as well on Super Tuesday.
So mainline Democrats across the country, not just here, and I'm sure it's happening here, are apoplectic about Bernie Sanders taking the front of this race because he's got the same kind of out-of-nowhere trajectory, they say, that Donald Trump had 4 years ago. He seems unstoppable, and they're worried because they don't think that he can beat Donald Trump. Sanders spoke at the South Carolina's Democratic Party dinner in Charleston on Monday night and addressed the electability worries expressed by those Democrats, including the state's Jim Clyburn.
I know you're hearing on TV a lot, Bernie can't win. Don't believe everything you hear on TV.
Can he win? Can he be the Democrats' Donald Trump?
Who knows, really, if he can. I think this nervousness, though, is the nervousness itself is making a lot of Democrats nervous. And a lot of folks feel that if you put all the non-Bernie candidates together, they are getting more support than Bernie. They're worried about the down ballot races, and they're trying to get somebody to drop out and consolidate. But everybody's looking around like, I'm not gonna drop out as long as as long as I have the money to stay in the race. Now, many people have said vote blue no matter who, and you see folks like Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi being very cool about it and say we will get behind the candidate. But these stories are rumbling up, including a recent story in the New York Times that said people are already strategizing that if he gets gets there with a plurality of the delegates but not the majority, on the second ballot, will there be a Stop Bernie movement? And President Obama is saying, you know, keep calm, because right. something like that really could destroy the future of the party. And his folks are so... I went to a rally, Bernie rally, over 2,000 people of all races and ages, a lot of young people as well. And afterwards, they came outside and they marched to the early voting site. The thing is, traditionally, young voters do not vote as much, so they're wondering if he can change that by bringing them in. It's a big question mark, but... Nobody thought Trump would win.
When
so
Joe Biden was still in Las Vegas, he said, we're alive, we're coming back, and we're going to win. I ain't a socialist. Those are his words. Mm-hmm. I ain't a plutocrat. I am a Democrat and proud of it. So will Bernie Sanders' self-proclaimed position as a Democratic socialist play in South Carolina?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you have to look at, to your point, Mary, voters are very informed on this primary election. They know the issues, and I think, you know, while we're talking a lot about the money that's involved here, healthcare is still a top issue and concern for voters. And I think they are very aware that the plan that Senator Bernie Sanders is pushing, the Medicare for All, people would be, you know, some people who like the healthcare would be pushed off of that. So I think voters are still, that's aware, that's in their mind, and that's when they're going in, talking to them, going into the voting booth. That's going to be, I think, one of the biggest things that may be, you know, when you ask, is Bernie Sanders stoppable, that sounds like that could be an issue for him.
And South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn doesn't believe that the socialist credentials are going to play here.
I do believe it'll be an extra burden for us to have to carry. This is South Carolina. And South Carolinians are pretty leery about that title, socialist. And so I think that that would be a real burden for us in these states or congressional districts that we have to do well in.
So yesterday, Mayor Pete Buttigieg was here in Rock Hill. He was supposed mm-hmm. to be in Charlotte, and they moved it to the suburbs. they moved it to Rock Hill. Why did they do that? And both you, Mary, and you, Kaylin, were there. How many people showed up? What did he have to say?
There were 900 people there, huge crowd. He kind of made his final push at South Carolina voters here in Rock Hill. He said, you know, if I have your support, I'm here to thank you, but I am here to kind of ask for your support, and laid out his policies. But within that crowd, there were a lot of voters who were very undecided. They were kind of, you know, very aware that Sanders has been doing well nationally, but they weren't really sure that that's who they wanted, so they were looking for maybe more of a moderate candidate. I talked to the voter before, and she was like, I just want to hear him out. I think I want to know if his plans are logical, if they're realistic. And then I came to her at the end, and I was like, what do you think? Did you make up your mind? She was like, yep, he convinced me. So
wow.
It's kind of interesting. I heard from an older, more conservative man who was really liked his military background, which is very interesting. But I think when you say in that crowd of almost 1,000, you could count the number of black people there, literally.
Yeah.
And I would say, what, a half a dozen or so? Not very many. And that is his problem.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't he connecting?
Well, I think the question, you could turn it around. Why are so many white voters supporting someone who does not have traction with the black and brown voters who are the base of the Democratic Party? And I think that's it. And when I talk to them, I hear people basically saying he's young, he's inexperienced, they don't know him. And also, past is you know, what's going to be in the future. And they have studied the Douglas plan and they like it. When it talks about criminal justice reform, when it talks about entrepreneurship, but they say, how is he going to do this on a national level when in South Bend, Indiana, there were problems in these areas?
Right, and people are now very aware of how his policies as mayor adversely affected the black community in South Bend, Indiana, and so I think that's why he's still struggling to get that support.
I mean, that's interesting. You know, Mary, I was the mayor. Mayor Buttigieg was in Rock Hill back in the fall, I think, in October. Mm-hmm. Had a great crowd at the amphitheater. Again, probably 1,000 people.
He's been here a couple
yeah.
times.
And then at that event, I mean, again, the people, the black people in the crowd, there's probably 10.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and it's just, okay. and 3 months have passed. And it sounds like no change at all.
Your sister newspaper, you work for the Rock Hill Herald, mm-hmm. but your sister newspaper in South Carolina is the State in Columbia, and they surprisingly endorsed Buttigieg. Mm-hmm. Why? And has your paper jumped on that bandwagon?
We don't have anything to do with editorial decisions, so I'm not sure why. But I think it definitely shocked some people. We got a few emails, few questions about it, but.
Spoke yesterday. You got a one-on-one with Mayor Pete. What's he like? What did he tell you?
He's very good at speaking. He knows how to answer questions.
Charismatic.
Yes, charismatic, and I think people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did ask him, you know, do you see a clear path to the nomination? And he was very clear. He said yes, and it starts with South Carolina. He does hope to do well here, and he sees doing well in the Super Tuesday states.
But you were mentioning, Kaylin, that, or was it you, Mary, that he still has people concerned about him being gay.
Right.
And that is still coming up, right?
Mm-hmm, it is. The same woman I just mentioned she was very aware that his sexuality is questioned, kind of brought to the forefront, and she kind of said, you know, this is 2020, why is this being questioned? You know, it's not, he doesn't define him, and she really respected Buttigieg for having the courage to just be who he is.
But there are still people that are...
Right. Yeah. It's interesting when you hear this kind of thing brought up, it's the same as when folks talk about, say, Elizabeth Warren, it's like, I have no problem with a gay candidate, with a female candidate,
right.
But I'm afraid that other people,
yes.
and their main thing is, I mean, I just go anywhere, the gym, the market, and they come up to me and the first thing is, who can beat Trump? Who? That's what people ask. And that seems, they're all playing pundit. They're kind of gaming out their neighbors. You know, it's really, rather than just voting for the person they want to vote for.
The debate prior to the Charleston debate was the single most watched Democratic debate history.
Yeah.
I don't know what the ratings were for the Charleston debate, but certainly all eyes were on Charleston earlier this week. And these debates, how can I put this, have been getting steadily more dramatic.
And they're good.
Chaotic.
And certainly louder as this field simultaneously narrows while letting Mike Bloomberg and Tom Steyer in on the stage here. According to the New York Times' James Poniewozik, the debate on Wednesday in Charleston featured a unified message, and that message was...
Look, the fact is, here's the deal. I'm not out of time. You spoke over time, and I'm going to talk. Here's the deal.
You had to feel for Joe Biden. I thought it was the funniest part to me was when they were all on stage and you could tell they were all, you know, focusing on the black electorate in South Carolina. And there were all these white candidates. And all of a sudden they were bringing up these issues in the first 10 minutes that had not been brought up. I expected somebody to say, you know, I was born a poor black child. And, you know,
I found that everybody talking over everybody and trying to get a word in edgewise was very annoying, but it was also electrifying. Yeah. Do you think this helps or hurts these candidates?
Well, if you break it down to each candidate, Elizabeth Warren, it's clear that she comes in very prepared, but
you
watch all the Monday morning quarterbacking the day after, and it's still women. It's unfortunate, but women who are forceful, I guess, it hurts them.
Yep.
It hurts their image in a way. Honestly, I felt like Vice President Biden had gotten a B12 shot before he walked out on stage, because in the previous debates, that's been one of the critiques he's gotten, is that he has just been stumbling over his words, mm-hmm. and it seemed like he was very on the attack and very on his game. Poor Mike Bloomberg. They all clearly had a goal of
killing him.
That, but putting his feet to the fire on so many different topics. And I thought a lot of people were like, well, why are they going after him? They're attacking and all this. I thought it was great for people to learn, because Mike Bloomberg has blanketed the airwaves, social media, TV, radio with these ads. And it's very telling that, for one, we learned that President Obama did not give them authorization to use him in those ads. So, you know, yeah, it was, some people might say they were attacking each other, but the Democrats and journalists need to figure out who it's going to be.
It's called vetting, you know? And it's a primary, and they're fighting one another, and they are all realizing they got to get in there. And it's true, Mike Bloomberg was rising in the polls without being on one ballot or on the one debate stage.
Nobody could hold him accountable, and they held him accountable.
And then no one's going to drop out. I mean, Super Tuesday is so quick. No one's going to drop out Sunday or Monday. But after Wednesday, huge amount of pressure. I mean, if Biden does not win South Carolina, there'll be a huge call for him to get out of the race.
Right.
Everyone is going to face, almost everyone's going to face.
I mean, you'll start hearing, I'm assuming, Steve, candidates next week starting saying to each other, you need to get out.
They're both like Amy Klobuchar. I mean, they're giving out the delegates proportionately. So everybody's getting a few. But in the meantime, Bernie Sanders is slowly just, you know, accruing delegate.
I don't know if the debate changed Jim Clyburn's mind, because he did not endorse anybody until after the debate. And then, after the debate, he announced.
I know Joe. We know Joe. But most importantly, Joe knows us.
So Jim Clyburn is the highest-ranking African-American in Congress. He endorsed, obviously, Joe Biden, as expected. Put a Jim Clyburn endorsement into perspective. Does it matter that much?
I think so. I mean, it was huge. It was covered nationally and as well as locally. But what I find interesting, we were talking before we went on air, you know, you make the point, Mike, that Jim Clyburn didn't endorse anybody until after the debate.
Right.
But we saw our own leaders.
Is he trying to be fair?
And I think he was trying to, much like voters, trying to figure out who's it going to be? Who deserves my support?
I think one more thing, too. I mean,
go ahead.
Just going to say, like, you know, sometimes we all kind of, like, as journalists and people really follow this, we think, why has it been so late? But sometimes you have to time these things right before. You win the news cycle that day. That really helped the vice president. So it's you know, and it may have been in his back pocket for a long time.
But. So we will look at what's coming up, which is Super Tuesday after the South Carolina primary when we come back. And there are other news stories that actually took place this week.
Really?
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? Other than politics. And we will do that when we come back. We're live from Amelie's in Rock Hill on Charlotte Talk's Local News Roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're at Amelie's in Rock Hill. That's the background noise that you hear. And we're here because tomorrow is the South Carolina primary, the first in the nation, the first in the South primary. And we have invited, because of that, Kaylin Derrickson, if I ever get your name right here. Kaylin Derrickson, reporter for the Rock Hill Herald, is with us, along with Mary C. Curtis, columnist and contributor to Roll Call on WCCB-TV, Jonathan Loeb from Spectrum News, and Steve Harris, and our political reporter here at WFAE. The latest Winthrop poll had Joe Biden up by just 5 points over his nearest rival. On Sunday, though, a new CBS News YouGov poll of South Carolina and had Biden leading with 28% of the vote. 2 days ago, the Monmouth poll had Biden with a large lead over Bernie Sanders. And the latest NBC Marist poll has Biden with 27% of the vote to Sanders' 23%. Which of these polls do we believe?
The day after.
The voter poll.
Good answer.
Learn how people voted.
All right. Winning in South Carolina will certainly keep Joe Biden's hopes alive. But will it cause voters in other states to really look at him again with fresh eyes if he wins big here?
I think so.
Yes.
Okay. Bernie Sanders answered questions on voters' questions on Wednesday at Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. That is the Reverend William Barber's church. And Bernie follows in the footsteps of Pete Buttigieg and Tom Steyer, who also spoke there. and said he had spoken more about the issues with those voters than in all of the televised debates, which says something about the televised debates, which is another topic. You wrote an article about this, Mary, for Time magazine.
Yes, Time has a special issue and project that's done with the Martin Luther King Jr. Estate, looking at the March of 1963, but also looking at issues that still need to be resolved when it comes to equality. And William Barber I interviewed as someone who is a champion of this, and they all make a pilgrimage to his church, and he also feels that there should be a debate just focused on poverty, because we never hear people talk about poor people and low wealth people, which is an amazing amount of people, even working people here in this country, or people who are one paycheck away from being homeless or not having medical benefits and voting rights and ecological justice. And he has a rule: you can come to his church and worship, and you can speak in a conversation, but you cannot speak from the pulpit. Because, as he says, we're political, but we're not partisan. Mm. And he's worked across the aisle with people like a conservative Republican North Carolina mayor when they were closing rural hospitals. So he wants these issues to be front and center, and he's very smart about that. And they're having a Poor People's Campaign June 20th in Washington, his own Poor People's Campaign that is continuing Martin Luther King's dream, a march on Washington to bring these issues to fore. And I think that would be his dream, to have these candidates talk about it and basically empower these folks. He feels like, let them speak.
So the South Carolina primary may be tomorrow, but this is the last news roundup before Super Tuesday, in which North Carolina will play a significant role. I think we have the third largest number of delegates of all the 14 states both voting on Tuesday. Who appears to be ahead in North Carolina? Do we know?
I mean, it's going to be this is going to be between Biden, Bloomberg, and Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at Charlotte, Bloomberg obviously has a huge presence in the city, has a huge presence throughout the state.
Yeah, he has the 17,000-square-foot headquarters in Charlotte.
It's really amazing.
And he's gotten the endorsements.
Times bigger than anybody else's.
Yeah.
He's gotten the endorsements of several, you know, Charlotte leaders,
including the mayor, although the mayor's daughter had something to say about that.
Yeah,
got a lot
not
of attention.
Not such a strong endorsement, but... And Biden is, you know, like I said earlier, he's just doesn't have the resources. He struggled to kind of be out there in Charlotte and in North Carolina, all these Super Tuesday states.
If Democrats want him to be the front runner so badly, why doesn't he have the resources?
I think it's because, and I'm not sure they want, the Democrats want him to be the front runner. A lot of Democrats,
they want a moderate,
want someone else, and he just hasn't, you know, inspired donors and a grassroots effort like some of the other candidates have.
One of the key races in North Carolina outside of the presidential race is the Democratic race for Senate to run against Tom Tillis, the incumbent Republican. And Cal Cunningham was endorsed this week by the Charlotte Post, by the Charlotte Observer, and by the Raleigh News and Observer, and some other smaller papers. What impact would that have on his candidacy?
I mean, I think it obviously helps. The big thing there, I mean, the most fascinating part of this race is the Republican super PAC, Faith and Power, that put in the $3 million of ads for Erica Smith to really boost her profile, meddling, you know. And then what's interesting is that Cunningham responded. I mean, he put up his own commercials very quickly.
Saying that was a lie.
Saying it was a lie. Mm-hmm. And I was just driving down here, and there was a billboard on 77 pushing Erica Smith. So I do think the polls show that despite the meddling, he's going to probably win the race.
Okay, so we have some other stories we need to talk about other than electoral politics here, and particularly with regard to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. And so we're going to bring in WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms for a quick review of those items. She's sitting in our studio very lonely up at the university area. At the end of last week's roundup, we brought up an as-yet unconfirmed story, Mary, about mandatory Title IX schools climate survey that asked students in grades 6 through 12 questions about their sexual orientation. That was not confirmed last week. It has since been confirmed, correct?
Confirmed and rescinded. Things happened very quickly after that news roundup because apparently what happened was somebody in the CMS research department decided there's this annual survey. It's based on figuring out school climate and specifically related to sex discrimination. But they decided to add some questions because they thought it would be good to know how many students are gender nonconforming or LGBTQ, and they wanted it broken down by school. And so they put these questions on and apparently did not run it up the flagpole, because I know school board members were scrambling as I was talking about it, as I was posting on a Facebook page, that I think schools and parents were saying, what's going on here? So on Friday, they basically came out with an explanation, but it essentially said, okay, yeah, we're doing this, but really the schools should have communicated to parents, and it should have been clear to everybody that this was not mandatory. And in fact, then when I got the material that they had given to schools, it was not at all clear. It said nothing about these new questions, which for those who don't remember, they added some questions for sixth grade and up that said, do you identify as transgender? And then it said, which of the following best describes your sexual orientation? And it gave a list of straight, gay, bisexual, pansexual, asexual questioning. So, and then for fifth graders, they were also asked where they were identified as male, female, non-binary, or gender fluid. So some parents were saying, you know, this is not age appropriate. This is not private, because our kids have to log in with their individual student ID to take this online. What's going on?
So school board chair Elise Dashew reacted to the news of this survey this way.
Somebody's common sense took a spectacular vacation.
Who was that somebody? Another case of transparency at CMS. Who was that somebody?
They have not said, and I've asked. It's pretty clearly in the accountability and research department. I have been told by a few people that Ernest Winston, whose name was on a letter introducing this survey, did not know about these questions until, again, the public questions started coming up. But it's not clear.
Why not? He's the superintendent, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and this is one that this lands on his watch. You know, we've had a lot of things that have bubbled up that he's had to deal with that you can say, yeah, but they started before him.
So you report that a flyer was sent to schools that had a line in red type that read, administration of this survey is, in capital letters, required for compliance with Title IX. So that means the schools were required to give the survey out. Were the students allowed to opt out of answering the questions?
CMS says they were, but I think that was not at all clearly conveyed to students, and probably not to teachers and principals. They cited that they also participate in this biannual youth risk behavior survey, which comes from the Centers for Disease Control, and it asks some very personal questions to a selected sampling of students. Have you attempted or considered suicide? Do you carry a gun? Have you tried this long list of drugs? And it does include a sexual orientation question that's much less detailed. You know, there are like four options instead of seven or eight. But the big difference here is that that is a paper and pencil survey. And so nobody enters an ID number. And I looked up the survey, and it has an instruction sheet in very clear English that goes to each student. And it says, we are not trying to figure out your name. We will not use your name. And if you aren't comfortable with any of these questions, you don't have to answer them. So that's kind of the right way to do it. And I think probably everyone would agree that the way CMS did this Title IX survey is the wrong way to do it.
Okay, don't go away. I'm coming back to you in a moment. But you mentioned the Centers for Disease Control. So let's talk about coronavirus for a second. Federal health officials are now warning about an impending coronavirus pandemic in the United States. The president takes issue with that, but other federal officials are urging local areas. And the Charlotte Observer had a headline story this morning that said it's not going to come to North Carolina, likely. But what are the hospital systems doing, Jonathan, to prepare?
So, I mean, they're preparing as if it will. And I think that's because we have the first confirmed case this week of someone who did not travel to an overseas country. So that's certainly concerning. But I know that hospitals are telling people and businesses to prepare in the event that it does come here. But it is important to point out that there are no confirmed cases
right.
of coronavirus in North Carolina.
So late yesterday afternoon, the Observer also reported that a deal that officials have been working on now, Steve, for more than 2 years to develop two blocks of uptown for shops and restaurants and some low-income apartments has collapsed. The deal has collapsed. This was to have been on North Tryon between 6th and 8th Street, which would have included the library and Spirit Square. That's going to go away. Now it's not. Is that the idea here? What happened?
So, this was a good story in the Observer that kind of looked at this really complicated deal. And really, one of the big high-profile parts of the deal was affordable housing. And the county manager said that it's simply under the way the deal is set up now, it's too expensive to put it there.
And the culprit, as I understand it, was the demand for affordable housing. It was a key component of this project, and evidently Mecklenburg County and Enlivion, which is the new name for our housing authority, are blaming each other. Why?
So I think there was a master developer that they were talking to about doing the project. And as I understand it, Enlivion was willing to offer a ground lease on land that they own, and the developer wanted just to buy the property outright. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, I think that the developer said that it would need about $35 million to do the affordable housing. So the county is saying, like, we're still committed to doing housing. It just may not be right on that site. Mm-hmm. And in theory, you could, right, you've got a rail line that runs through there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're building the streetcar. So there are other places that you could do with housing that would still make it, pretty easy for people to get to work.
So Dina DiOrio, the county manager, Mecklenburg County manager, said that those plans have now been shelved. What does that mean?
So it means I think they're going to, I think that the whole concept isn't dead. I think that area will, in theory, will still be redeveloped. What I think is interesting is there's been a lot of projects like this,
yeah,
where that really complicated public-private partnerships where they've been talked about for years. I mean, Brooklyn Village, right? Nothing's happened. Gateway Village. There's a lot.
Yep.
And you start getting these things that are too complicated, very difficult to do.
So I'm going to go back to Ann very quickly because we're really short on time, Ann. But after word leaked out a couple of weeks ago that the three high schools that voters said yes to in a 2017 bond referendum were going to be downsized. They were chopping off 25 classrooms in each of these three high schools. Why are they scaling these projects back very quickly?
They're saying it's not to save money, but on the other hand, they don't have enough money. They're saying it's still the right size for students. And kind of an interesting twist on this, they had said when the news came out that, oh, we haven't actually made that decision. But at this Tuesday meeting, when people talked about going back to 125, their staff said, well, that would actually delay the project because we've been designing for 100. So they did make the decision.
So voters said yes 2 years ago to $922 million in bonds. Now people in the audience at that meeting on earlier this week are calling it bait and switch. And because we're also asking for more money, for less.
Yes.
If that's the case, how do they come up with the $922 million in bonds? Why don't we know what things cost before we raise money?
Well, what Dennis Licaria, the consultant, said is that this is actually an 800 and something, I don't remember the exact number, but it was X amount of dollars in 2017. If they could have snapped their fingers and had it done at those costs, they would have had several million dollars left over. They figured in about 11% escalation over the course of the bond. They're seeing more like 20% now. But they also, I think, didn't do a good job of calculating in some land costs. That's become pretty clear.
One of the things that, thank you, Ann, one of the things that football fans have been wondering about is the fate of franchise quarterback Cam Newton, because we've gone through a coaching change. He only played two games last year. He has not been healthy. What's going on? And in Cam's case, people have been posting on Instagram and Twitter. A person named Nikki Wolf on Twitter tweeted, the Panthers and Cam have turned into a broken-up couple, passive-aggressively posting on social media about each other, and the fans are like the friends awkwardly watching from the outside. And Cam himself posted an Instagram video this week of him, I think, working out or planking or something, and talking to the camera. He's worked up.
Yeah.
Have they committed?
No. As the Observer very astutely pointed out, there's been no firm commitment that Cam Newton will be playing in the 2020 season, although Matt Rhule said this week that he wants him on the roster. So okay, that was the extent of it.
CIAA tournament is here for the very last time for a couple of years before it goes to your hometown, Mary, Baltimore.
Yeah.
Are we going to try to get him back in 5 seconds or less?
I don't think we will be able to.
They want to, but I don't know. You know, there were some charges of price gouging, and they want a new city.
Yeah, the history is not comfortable at the moment.
It's not comfortable.
We've come to you this hour from Amelie's in Rock Hill, South Carolina, with Kaylin Derrickson, reporter from the Rock Hill Herald, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Steve Harrison from WFAE. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.